The Top 100 Project is sponsored by sparkplugcoffee.com. If you're a coffee lover, you know that the secret to the best cup of joe is freshly roasted beans. Unfortunately, most coffee you find at the grocery store or your local shop was roasted months before it got to you, which is why you need Sparkplug Coffee in your life. Sparkplug uses only premium Arabica beans directly sourced and fairly traded. They have many blends and roasts to choose from, including a rotating special blend for those of you that like to switch it up, and decaf or half-caf for those of you who love the taste more than you love the jitters, or maybe you just want to be able to drink twice as much. But best of all, Sparkplug always delivers this fantastic coffee right to your home or office within a week of being custom roasted right here in Toronto. So whether you like espresso, double cappuccino, double macchiato, or just boring old drip coffee, you will taste the difference. It's time for your favorite cup to start coming from your own kitchen, so plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100. Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey, folks, and many thanks for checking out the Next 100 Project, the podcast formerly known as the Top 100 Project. Early warning, we like to spoil movie secrets. My name is Ryan Ellis, and my co-star in this talkie venture is my fellow union member, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
You militant union lady. All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture are Roger and me. What is Michael Moore's weakest box office performer of his 8 films, including one non-documentary, adjusted for inflation?
I was surprised to learn that it was Canadian Bacon.
The non-documentary.
I saw Canadian Bacon starring John Candy and Rhea Perlman, I think.
Yes. And a lot of other people, too. Alan Alda's in it. Yeah.
It made less than $1 million. Maybe I saw it because it was a Hollywood film explicitly about Canada, which is kind of hard to come by.
Playing on the typical Canada cliches and tropes.
Mm.
But it was fun. I saw it in the theater, too. It only made $325,000, adjusted, incidentally. His weakest documentary performer, do you know what that is?
It's the big one. I knew this. I remember it kind of came and went in theaters. I saw that in theaters because I was such a big fan of Roger and me. I was in college at the time, and I dragged a friend with me. It's his weakest movie, for sure, by far, and it just doesn't stand up to Roger and me.
And it was his second documentary ever. He didn't make a doc for a long time because he was doing the TV show, what was it called, The Awful Truth?
He did TV Nation first, and then The Awful Truth followed.
Right. And then Canadian Bacon, of course, was in there, too.
And I think the movie's about his book tour as well.
He was busy in a lot of things, yeah, it's true. The one he just did this past year, Where to Invade Next, which we haven't seen, but we want to see, did okay. Not as well as a lot of his other films have done, but it did not bad. And that's one of the themes in this podcast, successful documentaries.
It's his weakest performing doc in a long time.
Oh, yeah. All right, well, this one is Roger and Me, and it is the 15th Next 100 Project film, and it was not nominated for an AFI list of any kind because it's a documentary, so it has no chance. No Oscar nominations either. After screening the picture at several film festivals, including the Toronto International Film Festival, Warner Brothers released the film on December 20th, 1989. So Bev, explain the movie for those who haven't seen it in a long time with the skinny.
Documentarian Michael Moore investigates what happened to his hometown of Flint, Michigan during the 1980s, when General Motors, still a highly profitable company, instituted massive layoffs. Moore's main quest is to get an interview with GM's CEO, Roger Smith.
Or how about a nutshell? Heck of a job, Roger! I should do my George W. Bush voice. Heck of a job, Brownie! Anyway, that was the best I could do. So, the numbers in Rotten Tomato land. 100% of critics who've ever reviewed Roger and Me liked the movie. 29 fresh reviews, but only 79% of audiences. It was 103rd at the 1989 U.S. box office, which again is not bad for a documentary. It did make nearly $7 million. It's one of your favorites, Bev, and you said last week it's one of your three favorites. So what are the other two?
Well, the other two are films that we already covered in the Not 100 Project. Mm-hmm. Back when we were still doing the Top 100 Project, and those are When Harry Met Sally and The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
My three favorite films are those two and Roger and Me.
What a diverse group you have there.
What can I say? I like all kinds of movies.
Well, this is our first ever documentary. We'll do more as we go along. And as we said last week, this is in honor of Hot Docs, which will start a few days after we post this podcast. We've been to that festival 3 times, I guess, and you've been more than that.
I've seen well over 100 movies in that festival over the years.
It's getting to be a bigger and bigger film festival. People hear it now and generally still think I'm saying hot dogs.
Yeah.
But more of them know what I'm talking about now. And I think another 5 or 10 years, people will actually know exactly what I'm talking about when I say the Documentary Film Festival in April and May every year.
Yeah, it helps that Toronto already has an incredibly successful international film festival that everybody knows, the Toronto Film Festival, every September. So the city already has a structure for it and the interest for it. Hot Talk's really built from the ground up. It's been around for decades. If you live in Toronto, I always recommend it to everyone I know, every film buff I know. It's an incredible festival, and it's actually, like, quite a bit more affordable than TIFF, than the Toronto Film Festival. And one of my favorite things about going to festivals at all is they usually will have great Q&As with the directors, and the directors over and over will talk about how Toronto audiences seem to love documentaries. So I guess you and I are not alone, or maybe it's just a unique thing with Torontonians or this part of Canada or something.
I love the Q&A thing too, and you don't always get to do it because sometimes the director or the actors, because it's a documentary, but characters, so the producers, the editor, whoever, aren't there. But in a lot of cases, you get 3, 4, 5 people up on stage, and you can ask questions for, not hours, but probably a good 25, 30 minutes.
And sometimes the stars will be there. We saw Tig Notaro's documentary last year, and Tig Notaro herself was there.
All right, so back to the movie at hand, though. Roger and Me, you said you love it. I'm a fan of the film, too. It's not my favorite Michael Moore movie. Obviously, it's your favorite of all of his films, but let's hear why you like it so much.
Well, it's been my favorite since I first saw it. One of my high school teachers showed it to our class in the 11th grade. Part of the reason I love it so much is because at the time, I honestly had never seen anything like it. To me, documentaries were something that was dour and serious and boring and educational. And here was this film that was so irreverent and silly, but still treated the subject matter with real gravity and respect. I can't argue with the complaints that he fudged the timeline a little here and there to tell the story. There was a couple of facts that were straight up not true, although I would argue that none of them were super relevant facts to the thesis that he was trying to prove. Okay, as a piece of journalism, it is suspect, but as a film, I still, all these years later, find it completely irresistible.
It sounds like he's flat out wrong. Fat cats do this kind of stuff. They make a lot of money. Sometimes they make billions, and they certainly have made many tens of millions. This is not capitalism. It's not about putting people out of work and sending your company off to some other country to make more profits. Nothing wrong with making profits, but it's about putting the best product out there and letting people decide. Well, GM was doing that for a long time, and then they thought, well, let's expand down to Mexico. And then all these people that they employed, do they have a responsibility to those people? I think they do. But even if you don't agree that they do or they do not, that is so un-American to take your business elsewhere and make so much money. Look at what Apple does, though. They have their phones made in another part of the world. If they had American people making those things, they'd be a lot more expensive for all of us to buy. But that's probably more American than the way things are done.
Well, that's what the phones cost. That's really what it should come down to. We save money by getting them made in a country where their dollar, so to speak, is lower, but also where they are free legally to mistreat employees and to squeeze every bit of labor out of them they can without repercussions. So there's a real immorality to globalization when you look at the way that they exploit countries that will exploit their workers. But the problem is, if you're a capitalist, then as soon as one car company takes their factories to Mexico or to China, then they have a competitive edge over all the other factories.
So you better do the same.
Exactly, because they can charge less for their product because it costs them less to manufacture it. So as soon as one company does it, the other companies don't really have any choice. And if you happen to be the first one that's callous enough to do it, your stock price is going to go through the roof and you're going to stand to make a lot of money. Especially if you're one of these CEOs, go into a company, work for a few years, make their bonus, you know, hit their numbers, and then move on to a different company with their success record.
Or if they fail, they get the golden parachute.
There's no consequences to their actions, really. When you look at individual incentives versus company incentives, it is a really twisted system, and there's so much wrong with it. But everything has been rigged so that the rich keep winning, winning, winning. I mean, we're all really learning more about it now ever since the 2008 crash and Occupy Wall Street, and people are opening their eyes. Maybe they knew about it all along, but it's getting harder and harder to put up with it because inequity is so much worse now than it even was in 1989 when this film came out. And the result of that inequity and what Michael Moore does is he turns the camera on these very real human beings and their very real suffering. He kind of makes fun of them, but I wouldn't actually say that he does. I think he has real love for these goofball people. They're weird and they're quirky and they're poor, yes, but they don't deserve their poverty. They don't deserve what's happened to them.
Almost every movie he's ever made has gone back to Flint in some way, even if it's just a small part of it. You might think Fahrenheit 9/11 would have nothing to do with that. But even that one has scenes in Flint. Obviously, the city's even worse off now than it was then. They lost about 30,000 jobs in just over a decade in the 80s. Now there are fewer than 10,000 workers working for GM in Flint.
There's somewhere between 5,000 and 7,200 workers still. And, of course, lately we've all heard about the water crisis and what is happening to the people that are left there. It's disgusting.
A kick in the balls if it's already bad enough, and then they can't even drink their water or bathe in it.
Yeah, it's disgusting.
And one of Michael Moore's more recent movies, Capitalism, A Love Story, definitely was maybe not an intended sequel to Roger and Me, but they're bedfellows. And you see a lot of the results of what was going to happen in there. The eviction storyline, Fred Ross, who's just doing his job, he's in a tough position. He worked in a factory before he got the job as the eviction deputy. And that kind of thing pays off very well in Capitalism, because we're seeing the very beginning of the film and all throughout it, people are being kicked out of their homes because they can't afford them. Some of them are conned into bad mortgages or refinancing. This film doesn't get into that directly, but you can see where that started. Two other key things I want to say when it comes to the fat cats versus people with a conscience. And we'll get into Roger Smith in a second, because he's the ultimate fat cat in this movie. But Larry Stecko is his name. He sued Moore and won. He was one of the people at that statue party, where people are just standing around as statues. Really? And he didn't think that his portrayal as a rich asshole was fair. I don't know how exactly he won his lawsuit, but he did. Michael Moore's been sued many times, and maybe that's where that started for him with this film. Probably hadn't been sued before that. The flip side of this, Ed Asner, the voice of the guy in Up, legendary longtime actor. I think he's even still alive. Anyway, he donated some money when Moore cold-lettered him, meaning he sent a letter to him and said, can you help us out?
Really?
And he was nobody then, let's not forget. Michael Moore would have been nobody to him. He was just coming off working for a magazine called Mother Jones in San Francisco. It was a newspaper, one of those two. But he got fired shortly before he started making this film.
Yeah, he sued them for wrongful dismissal. That settlement is part of what paid for Roger and Me.
Mm-hmm. But how about that? Larry Stecko, Ed Asner. Not that Larry Stecko is the bad guy, but Ed Asner just gives money to a liberal cause. It doesn't have to be a liberal cause. He's helping out a young potential filmmaker who he didn't know was going to become a big player. But let's get to the real fat cat in this movie, and that's Roger Smith. What did you think of his portrayal? Because it has been said, Michael Moore did interview him. He just chose to make it look like he was being avoided. And then even when he gets to the stockholder meeting and tries to speak, I watched that scene very closely. It looks very much like Moore could just be fudging it. Then when he's at the microphone, I have a question here. Oh, we're adjourning. That's not actually in the exact same time frame. Maybe it is, but it looks to me like it could very easily have been fudged.
A lot of people, including a lot of people at General Motors, went to quite a bit of trouble to refute any of the facts presented in Roger and Me, and nobody refuted what happened in that stockholders meeting.
No?
I agree. It looked like it might have been just a trick of filmmaking, but you do catch him with a hot mic, Roger with a hot mic.
That's true.
Did you see that? Yeah, it was almost too late, but, you know, we decided to wrap it up. So he did interview Roger Smith before he even started making the film, and that's the interview that people are referring to. But he knows, and the audience knows, and the audience knows that his tactics to get an interview with Roger Smith are silly. They are never going to get him in to see him. He includes these scenes of him going to the headquarters or going to the country club because they're cute and they're prankish. And they also illustrate this systematic divide that keeps Smith separate from the public. He's illustrating that invisible wall that would stop any of us from approaching a CEO and asking him to account for their actions. And reminding us that we, too, would have no idea how to get in the same room as our boss's boss's boss. I mean, you and I both work for very big companies that have suffered plenty of layoffs.
And just 12 levels of management.
12 levels of management.
There's 112 levels of management at the CBC.
I know my CEO's name, and I probably even could get my hands on his email address, but would I know how to even begin to get in the same room as him? No, forget it. That's the divide between us and access to these people. So the whole conceit that he's trying to get an interview with Roger is just kind of like a silly storytelling device. I don't think it's the point of the film that he's actually trying to argue that what we should be outraged about is that it's hard to get an interview with Roger Smith. No, that's not what we should be outraged about. And actually, in the big one, I'm pretty sure it's the big one where he interviews the Nike CEO. Yeah, and he has this really famous interview with Phil Knight, who agreed to be interviewed and agreed to answer all these pretty difficult questions from Michael Moore regarding the fact that he had a whole chapter in his book calling Phil Knight a monster, and he responded to it, and it was actually like a pretty interesting interview where Phil Knight comes across a lot better than you think of him, first of all, because he agreed to be interviewed.
He's putting on his best face, but he seems like a pretty nice guy, as I recall.
He seems like pretty real, and Roger Smith
doesn't.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't care. He doesn't need to be liked by his minions. Like most CEOs, they may put on a good face and read from A Christmas Carol at their stockholders meeting, But he doesn't give a damn about you or I.
I've heard many times that the obligation of a CEO is to the investors, the stockholders actually, specifically. Mm-hmm. I know that legally is true. Forgive my liberal thing here, but that is so goddamn immoral and wrong. Getting back to what I said a few minutes ago, well, about putting out the best product. Your job as CEO should be to make the best car for the consumer. And in the process, you're probably going to have a decent work environment for the workers. At one point in the movie, they talk about how people who are disgruntled maybe can't be trusted. They're not going to do the job properly. As a disgruntled person in a company with a union, I do the job as well as I ever did, and I do it for pride as much as anything else. And I bet a lot of these same people who probably knew they were going to be put out of work, or at least could have been put out of work, I'm not likely to get laid off like a lot of these people, would work hard just because that's what they do. They want the car to be good. They want to make sure that they can say at the end of the day, I did the best I could and I was laid off anyway, rather than, oh, I just phoned it in and fuck it, I probably should have been fired anyway. Most people I know wouldn't want to handle things that way.
No, and my loyalty to the company that I work for has certainly been suspect over the years and everything they've put us through, but my loyalty to the team that I work with and the show that we make has always been really strong, and I have pride in my work that goes above and beyond the decisions that are being made many rungs up the ladder, really far away from me. People that probably have never even heard of the show I work on. There's so many levels of management, which is another crazy thing about capitalism, that there are massive companies where the CEO probably couldn't even name all of the smaller companies that they own.
Never mind any of their workers. I don't expect them to know all the workers, but having some kind of role in what they do would be some kind of factor. And yes, I think morally you have an obligation to the citizens of your company, the employees of your company, and the citizens of your country, you know, USA, USA. Do they have an obligation when they're some of the richest companies? GM was then, and I guess it's doing well again now. But the Waltons, who own Walmart, McDonald's still does very well, even though it's not as successful as it once was. Do they have an obligation to the citizens of America? Yes, they fucking do.
And a lot of people smarter than me have pointed out, in the long run, if you want your company to be successful, you have an American company, especially if you're manufacturing something like cars, you benefit from making sure that the people you're selling cars to can afford a car. Mm-hmm. It is part of driving the engine of the economy that you're working in, that you're selling this product to.
Well, I've said this many times. One of the obligations of the CBC is to simply employ people. American politicians go on and on and on about how government jobs aren't real jobs. Okay, maybe some of these people are sandbagging it like in any other company, and it happens in unions, we know that, and it's shitty. But if somebody's being paid $50,000 a year, $100,000 a year, whatever they're making, they're buying things and they're contributing to the economy. They are buying a car or a house, or they're just buying things. And that country, and ours too, here in Canada, is obsessed with the notion of always moving things ahead that way.
Studies have shown over and over that when you give the middle class and the lower classes money, they spend it. They immediately put it back in the economy. We save, but we hope, ideally, to die as close to broke as possible. We don't have legacies or dynasties, whereas the super rich don't spend all that money that they have. They tend to hoard it. They tend to put it in accounts in Panama or who knows where else.
And this didn't start in the 80s when Reagan became president, but my nutshell was going to be heck of a job, Ronnie. Because that son of a bitch and a lot of the policies he put in place did not help that country at all. He did not help the little guy. He didn't help the middle class person with these policies. I understand why they thought trickle-down economics could have worked. But the fact that they keep pumping this out at people is such a lie, because it isn't going to, because of what you just said. The rich people, they do sometimes, granted, but they don't often enough put money back into the system when they have such incredible tax breaks. They aren't taking care of people. This is why you have government. People like this, if they were taking care of things, if they were making the schools better, and if they were building the roads, and they were building the bridges, and taking care of the infrastructure, if that was happening from private enterprise properly, then okay, give them the money and they'll do it. But they don't do it, and that's been proven over and over again. That's why you have regulations, and that's why you have government.
And the people at the top rig the system so that people like you and I, and actually I hate to give you and I as an example, because we are middle class and we do just fine, partially because we work in places that have unions.
Yep, I used to be anti-union, by the way, and I'm not anymore. I'm not exactly hardcore pro.
It's not perfect. The union system is not perfect.
But we see what happens when people don't have them.
One of the most interesting things they point out in the film, if we can get back to talking about Roger.
Yeah, we should do that, yeah.
They talk about the Great Sit-Down Strike, which was the birth of the United Auto Workers, which took place in Flint. That's a pretty significant union. It's a significant moment in history of labor. The entire middle class was built upon unionized workers and their negotiations with the company to make sure that they just made a living wage. None of these people got rich, probably like you and I. They didn't necessarily want to. They were happy to just make a good living. But in interview after interview, it simply becomes clear unions are useless when your competition is coming from an entirely different country, when they're just going to uproot and move somewhere and effectively break the union, which is a strategy that a lot of companies, including the companies we work for, have used various tactics to try and do as well.
At least weaken it.
At least weaken it. There's a point where Moore asks somebody, should they do another sit-down strike? Their answer is, I don't think it would do any good. If they stopped working, they would just uproot the company.
Wasn't that the governor of Michigan?
Yeah, I think so.
And we were both impressed with the fact the guy was honest enough to say it. He wasn't being an asshole about it. He was just saying, I don't think it would do any good. Sorry, man.
Yeah, and that you as workers, as labor, you don't actually have any leverage anymore. And that was a sea change in America and manufacturing and the middle class. And look what's happened over the years is workers don't have leverage. Is now you have a city where the people who still live there don't even have safe drinking water, their children get poisoned, and there doesn't seem to be any repercussions for the people responsible for it. It's really heartbreaking.
The rich people in this movie suggest the auto workers who lost their jobs find other jobs, and many of them did do that, as shitty as they are. But they're trained professionals on something else, and it's just a matter of, well, you'll be okay doing something else. There's the pets or meat woman
who
just kills a rabbit on camera, which I'm sure was shocking and heartbreaking view. Well, you've seen the movie many times, so it would have been surprising to you at least.
I'm trying to remember how I reacted to it the first time, because I mean, a teacher showed it to us in high school. I don't think somebody could get away with showing that scene to a classroom full of 16-year-olds in this day and age, but I'm sure it upset me. And I remember I have a friend who to this day will never forgive me for having her watch this movie with me and me telling her, no, it's this really good movie, and forgetting to warn her that a bunny gets bludgeoned to death. And there's no warning for that scene. There is no moment, even when I've seen it many times, I still wouldn't have time to look away when it's about to happen. It cuts from a totally different scene to suddenly she's got the bunny pinned down, and it's within seconds that the first hit comes down.
And then
the
she guts it, too.
Yeah, right in front of you while she just talks about her situation, about making a rabbit code, about how the health people are coming after her for not doing things according to code. She's the main character in the short sequel called Pets or Meat. Mm-hmm. She's one of those goofy, endearing characters that I talk about where a lot of people might think that he's making fun of her, but I don't think for one second he's making fun of her. I think she is a great representation of a very American individual who has been backed into a corner. This is her strategy for getting by. And she says, this is just what you have to do to eat.
It's her version of a slaughterhouse, too, and we maybe have moral issues about that. But then anybody who eats hamburgers really can't speak too strongly about how horrifying that is, because where do you think that meat comes from? And yeah, how do you think it gets there? It isn't nicely.
I love animals, but I don't have a problem with hunters. I don't have a problem with people who raise something for meat and then eat it for meat. It would be the same if it was a chicken or a cow. Mm-hmm. I don't really lose sleep over that scene.
Especially since this movie is putting it off that she's pretty desperate. Well, you talked about making fun of her. He does make fun of other people. And this is the Michael Moore thing, the gotcha questions. He is unfair to Miss Michigan. And he's also unfair to the country club manager when he goes in there, and Roger Smith comes in this club a lot, doesn't he? And he's not there at that moment. The guy's telling you he's not there. But even if he is, the country club manager doesn't owe you that, Michael. And the Miss Michigan scene, she's a nice woman. She just wants to do her thing. She doesn't understand the situation, or maybe she doesn't really care. But in any case, she's made to look stupid. And he's done this many times. He also does the thing where somebody gets crying in the film and the camera zooms right in. It's a technique he's been criticized for every time he's ever done it. But what did you think about the gotcha questions? Also with the tone-deaf celebrities like Pat Boone, Anita Bryant, Bob Eubanks.
Yeah, Bob Eubanks, my God. Never again will anybody underestimate the power of a... What am I talking about? People underestimate the power of a live mic all the time. But he makes that terrible sexist, homophobic, and anti-Semitic joke all wrapped up in one. Bob Eubanks, there's no excuse. The man has spent his life on camera. He should know better. Anita Bryant, I think she comes across just fine. You know, they're just doing their jobs. I've never really found it that embarrassing, their portrayal. What's most embarrassing, perhaps, is the GM representative that he gets a pretty lengthy interview with, with his comb over and his condescending answers. Well, what do you want me to do about it? GM's not going to do anybody any favors if they go bankrupt. Why doesn't everybody just invent loot rollers or what you? Yeah, when his answers are oversimplified and not very sympathetic to the people who've been hurt by the situation. As for Michael Moore's tactics, he doubles down on this in future films, and I always think of the example in Bowling for Columbine where he interviews a clearly senile Charlton Heston.
Yes.
And he kind of corners him and cajoles him and leaves this photograph of a little girl who died in a gun incident.
In Flint,
yeah. Yeah, there you go. Do I feel sorry for Charlton Heston?
The thing I've always said about that scene is Heston answers the question. He thinks that the reason why there's so many gun deaths in America is because they were born in violence. Michael Moore's response is talking about, the Crusades and World War II over in Europe and all these other things. Okay, maybe Heston's wrong, but that's Heston's answer, and Michael won't stop badgering the old man.
It would have worked
that.
Fine had Heston not still been so frail. I think that was probably the misjudgment that Michael Moore made. But as far as his tactics go, people are used to documentaries being made by and for liberal, middle-class people who are well-educated.
But they weren't very political before this movie, though. I don't think.
You don't think The Thin Blue Line was a political film?
Well, Errol Morris is kind of like Michael Moore, and the guy who was changing the way docs are made.
Yeah, that's true. Docs before the 80s, you have something like Great Gardens. Docs were just such a fringe type of film.
The filmmaker was rarely in the movie, and that's the other thing. Yeah. This guy is a star of his own movie almost every time, except for some of the more recent ones. He's not on camera as much and not quite as jokey, and we haven't seen Where to Invade next. Maybe he's in the movie more again.
But people would have associated documentaries with activism, or you would think of the public television documentary, and they were really always made to appeal to liberal elites, if I can just use that as a blanket term, whereas Michael Moore is not even middle class. He really does represent the working class of America.
He did back this time, actually. He doesn't anymore. I think he thinks he does.
I think he does. I think he still is speaking for these people. I think he still lives at least with one foot firmly in that world. And this is the thing, is he understands how working class people think, what they care about. He doesn't try to argue with people with facts. What he really is trying to work with is emotions. That's what makes his films effective. And he's using the same tactics the right-wing people use. You know, I like to always say Michael Moore fights fire with fire. I don't like it when people on the right will use fear-mongering and snappy rhyming language and sound bites to convince people of things that don't feel true. Michael Moore kind of does the same sort of thing. I think his intentions are better, and I obviously agree with him a lot more. But he's not trying to win you over with intellect. He's trying to just win you over
with
manipulation, an emotional manipulation. It's not something that a documentarian is supposed to do. It's not something a journalist is supposed to do. So people criticize him for that.
That's one of the influences of this film, is that docs with the director as the focal point, especially in his own movies, but also in things like Super Size Me, which I enjoyed immensely. And it seems like Morgan Spurlock did his research and his homework, because we kind of instinctively know McDonald's cannot be a healthy thing to eat on a regular basis. That was the point of his movie, that they had said in some release that you can eat this as a part of your healthy lifestyle. And then he found out, look what happens to a healthy young man like me when I eat this food all the time. But that's one of the legacies of Roger and Me, and the Michael Moore style is something as good as Super Size Me.
And another thing that Super Size Me did that Michael Moore does all the time is he gives you the medicine with a spoonful of sugar. Mm-hmm. He comes on and he's a charismatic guy. He inserts himself in the story. He dresses it up in this conceit that, I'm just going to eat McDonald's for a month. But, you know, while you're watching me do this, I'm going to sneak in all this information.
Yeah.
I'm going to make sure that everything's super entertaining and super funny. You're going to pay attention because I'm just making you want to watch this without realizing that you're being educated and convinced to my point of view, his point of view being that McDonald's was being irresponsible. So he proves that thesis with this gimmick, but he proved his thesis with the information as well. I think Michael Moore relies more heavily on, I wouldn't say the gimmick, but trying to directly appeal to people's emotions. And part of that is through winning them over with comedy, with being goofy, with pranking the guy at
the country
club.
He could be a stand-up comic.
Yeah, he's a very funny guy. He's a very likable, charismatic guy, which is why he makes a great character in his films, even though I know he turns a lot of people off. But I think that's a lot more to do with his politics than his charisma.
I think I have to bring up something we talked about way back on one of the Chaplin films. It may have been City Lights. We compared Charlie Chaplin, who was a wealthy Hollywood star, but playing the tramp, to Michael Moore. I think they both were the wealthy showmen who are putting on an I'm just like you front. I don't think that either of them are phonies, because I think that in both cases, especially Moore, their hearts are in the right place.
Yes.
But Michael does the baseball cap, the jeans, the hands in the pockets thing in every movie he's ever made. And it does come across as showmanship for the sake of showmanship rather than I'm still like this. I'm not saying he has to live some poor lifestyle in Flint and never change, never make more money and that kind of thing. But I don't think he's one of the little people like he maybe was at one time.
I've read a couple of his books. He's pretty upfront about the fact that he is wealthy, and he talks about the car he drives. He talks about the apartment that he owns in New York City. I don't think he hides it and tries to pretend that's not him. I think he probably feels that if he started wearing blue jeans that fit him properly and a hat that was less than 25 years old, he wouldn't feel like himself. But he has actively, throughout his career, worked hard to send this money back into the community, either through raising money or through giving money himself and helping out as much as he can. A great example is when he sold Roger and Me to Warner for an unprecedented $3 million, which doesn't sound like a lot now, and it's not, but at the time, very few documentaries even made a profit. They were basically like a loss leader. So for him to sell his movie for more than 10 times he paid to make it, part of the deal was they had to pay the rent for every family that we saw get evicted in Roger and Me. Warner Brothers paid their rent for 2 years.
Yeah.
He probably was coming from a position as a documentary filmmaker. He was a beggar, not a chooser. Yeah. He was an unknown. He probably stood to lose a lot of money because he mortgaged his house to make this film.
He's taken on some honorable causes in the movies. So you've got laid off workers in this film and his hometown going under. The Nike stuff in the big one. The guns in Bowling for Columbine, and the violence in America in general. That movie is really about violence as much as it's about guns. Fahrenheit 9/11 is about politics very blatantly, the Bush administration, and the wars that were going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. Capitalism, like I said, a sequel to this of sorts, but more directly about capitalism and how it just fucks with America, and these guys keep getting away with it. Sicko about the healthcare problems that they have. At least now they have universal healthcare. It's not perfect, but it's better than what they had when he made Sicko. So he is taking on causes that affect regular people. I don't think he's missed too many major themes of what people do go through.
I'm sure he probably has a long list of issues he'd like to cover and talk about. I know one of the books he wrote, and he never made a film about it, was just about veterans.
Oh yeah, the way they're treated. All right, so back to the film, a few more things I want to say. The Auto World sequence is funny, but you can't blame them for throwing a Hail Mary to try to get some tourism there.
So apparently Auto World opened and closed before they started losing jobs. Although Michael Moore argues that that's not true. There's kind of a dispute of when exactly that Hail Mary got thrown out there. And you also can't blame anybody for not wanting to go to an auto plant themed park.
Yeah, but it is played for comedy because it is pretty absurd. Harkening back to a movie we did only a few weeks ago, The Wages of Fear, that's all about guys who don't have a union. And then they all, spoiler alert, die. Three of them on the job. The other one dies in a stupid accident after the fact. So we've already gotten so political on the podcast, we don't have to linger on the whole union thing. But I do want to talk about something that Moore says in the commentary. He feels like this movie failed because no jobs returned to Flint. Mission not accomplished. He said he made the movie for that reason alone. Bring attention to this and then things will change. And it didn't.
And I believe him. He sounds absolutely heartbroken. You know, he spends most of the commentary looking at images of Flint and lamenting all the ways that it's gotten worse since that film was made. He's genuinely heartbroken about it.
His father worked at GM on the spark plug assembly line, and in Capitalism he also talks about how he was raised middle class. Every couple of years they get a new car, they go on vacations, they were doing well. We talked about this just last week on No Country for Old Men, and other films too, we've talked about this in other podcasts, about how the 50s, man, we go back to the 50s when things are great, and I think that's a bullshit thing when people go into that kind of crap, because so many things were wrong socially in America, in the world, but America especially. But that notion, a middle class family in an industrial town like Detroit or Flint, could do just fine. And that's not so true anymore for an awful lot of people. So there's no cast to speak of per se. We've talked about the people that are in the movie primarily, at least. Skip on out of the technical stuff. It's a 1:37:1 movie, so we're seeing a square movie, which is unusual. We've seen a few of those with their 50s movies we've covered recently. But here's a modern one that is actually that ratio. The DVD looked all right, not wonderful or anything, but it's fine. The cinematography was actually done by four different people. Kevin Rafferty is one of those, and he especially was Moore's mentor. And that's one thing, too, about this movie, is that Michael found his legs immediately as a filmmaker and kept his style. You don't really see an evolution in the sense of, oh, he got a lot better. He was there right from the start. Paul Thomas Anderson, there's no connection between the two of them. He's another guy, when you watch Hard Eight, okay, yeah, some of his movies got bigger and grander, but he had the ground running too. When you see people like Scorsese or Spielberg, they were good in the beginning, but they got a lot better. But people like Moore and PTA, right away, they were damn good, and you could see how they didn't really change much. They found what they wanted to do, and they kept doing it. Not doing the same thing over and over again, necessarily, but they found a style, and then bang, I'm on, this is what I'm going to be.
this film affected me so profoundly when I first saw it, and I kind of credit Michael Moore with the reason I went to film school. One of my favorite things about it is the editing. It's well done, it's tight as a drum, and it's funny because he makes choices to include certain things that you might say, how does this advance the story? The woman selling Amway and how she calls him up and insists on coming back because she discovered that, well, she thought she was a spring, she was really a fall. And it's such a cute moment. He was smart enough to know that he could include that moment and it would add to the film and not slow down the story. And of course, there's the brilliant ending, and a lot of critics talk about it, where he cross-cuts between the shareholders meeting where Roger Smith is reciting from Dickens and there's a choir singing Santa Claus is Coming to Town. He intercuts that with families in Flint being kicked out of their home the day before Christmas Eve by Sheriff Deputy Fred Ross. It's really well cut. The audio, the way it intercuts, is really smooth and seamless, and it conveys his point perfectly with very few words. You know, it's not a narrated part of the story because it doesn't need to be. And even just the back and forth between people on golf courses and people being kicked out of factories, kicked out of their homes, killing bunnies for food.
You said a minute ago that was right around Christmas time. Well, the movie came out December 20th, so a lot of people that saw it in the first week or so would have been seeing it at the same time frame that that important sequence was set.
Yeah, so the editing of this film was honestly part of the reason I wanted to become an editor. And while I work in TV now, and there's lots of reasons for that, mostly unions. But if I had my way and if it was something that I could make a really consistent, safe living from, then yeah, I would be making documentaries.
Well, credit Jennifer Berman White and Wendy Stansler. They are the two credited editors. Documentaries rarely get nominated for Oscars, and they certainly don't win them. The one example I can think of is Hoop Dreams, which is a favorite of Siskel and Ebert in 94. That was nominated for the editing, but not for Best Documentary, ironically. Roger and Me probably should have been. Other movies Moore's made maybe should have been nominated for the editing.
Well, speaking of Oscar snubs, Roger and Me was not nominated for the Oscar. A lot of people blamed the small controversy that erupted over whether or not he was 100% accurate and the quality of the journalism in the film. But then a lot of people, including Roger Ebert, have countered that and said, you know what, the real reason it didn't get nominated is because it's not a voting body that decides who gets nominated for Best Documentary. It's a panel of specialists.
This has changed, but continue.
Yes, yeah, okay, so at the time that was true, and on that panel was a man named Mitchell W. Block, who was a distributor of documentary films, and it was like this known secret that he used his influence to get nominations for his films that his company distributed, because it's a really great way for a documentary to turn a profit. In the year that Roger and Me should have been nominated, 3 of the 5 films that were nominated for Best Doc were distributed by Block's company. The same thing happened for Thin Blue Line, and he may have intentionally left out these very popular films so that they wouldn't be competition for his films.
Oh, no doubt, because they would have been, you would think, slam dunks to win. All right, I see in your notes you have an awful lot of influence. I've got a few. We've talked about the fact that one of the biggest ones is that this influenced the guy's own movies and his own style. He found it right off the bat. And also that documentaries can be a profitable thing. Is that good or bad? Because when they become so political and they're on one side of the aisle, whichever side that might be, that's not really telling the facts because you're going to skew it in your own way. We already talked about whether or not he is too much of a showman and if he's actually being honest about what he's putting out there. But is it good or bad that documentaries are now a source of profit, much like TV news is?
Well, so are movies, so are books. It doesn't stop great works of art from being created.
They have a different job.
What do you mean they have a different job? You're saying like books
regular movies have a different job.
Non-fiction books have a different job from documentaries.
No, fiction books do. That's what you're talking about.
But non-fiction books make plenty of money. And what happens is when non-fiction books make money or non-fiction movies make money, they encourage more non-fiction movies to get made. So I'm just going to say, yes, it's a good thing. It means that people are watching them. Of course, there are going to be people out there who make something just strictly for profit, but history kind of shows that most of the documentaries that make money are made with pretty decent journalism, including most of Michael Moore's films. Like, he learned his lesson from Roger and Me. He's actually had a challenge out ever since Bowling for Columbine, $10,000 to anybody who can prove that any of the facts presented in his film are incorrect. Nobody's ever actually won that bet. He has a team of fact checkers to work with him to make sure that he's on point, but you could say the same about Super Size Me, or other movies that are kind of that ilk, like An Inconvenient Truth, that made a lot of money, but also probably did a lot of good. And it's a movie that helped get greenlit by the fact that documentaries at the time were conceivably a profitable investment.
Fahrenheit 9/11 made over $100 million and was number one.
It made opening way weekend, more than $100 million.
No, I know, but it'd been $50 million would have been a ton of money, and it was number one the weekend it came out.
Yes.
When I went to see it, it was packed, and I went to a 4 o'clock show on opening day.
Yeah, I lined up to see it. I was so happy because I was such a big Michael Moore fan. And actually, I lined up to see Bowling for Columbine, but Bowling for Columbine, I went to a somewhat obscure arty theater in Toronto, whereas I saw Fahrenheit 9/11 in, like, the big multiplex right downtown. Packed theater, people reacted like crazy. It was fantastic. I was so happy for that breakout, and it's kind of paid off in that, yeah, maybe there hasn't been a ton of blockbusters since as far as documentaries. I know Super Size Me did really well, and actually, do you know what is technically, I'm not sure if this is still true, but I remember when Fahrenheit 9/11, I was like, it's the highest grossing documentary of all time. Technically, the highest grossing documentary of all time, do you know what it is?
I see your notes, so I know what you're going to say. Go ahead, say it.
It's Jackass.
Oh, I thought it was Borat. I see.
Borat's Borat. Not a documentary. That's a fictional film. That's what I thought you were going to say. But Borat, I mean, I argue that Borat is
definitely faux documentary, though.
Yeah, but it's the same type of satire that I would say Michael Moore does. Kind of a candid camera thing where you go up to people who disagree with you and you kind of trick them into speaking what they really feel and then play it for laughs, kind of making fun of them. And Borat definitely does that. But no, Jackass, for all intents and purposes, is technically a documentary, and it made more money than Fahrenheit 9/11.
Right.
Actually, Jackass 3D probably made more money than everything else.
Another movie we should mention is definitely a brother to this film because it's the same state, Detropia, which we saw at Hot Docs a couple years ago, and that's about the downfall of Detroit, not Flint in this case. Same state, though, and for some of the same reasons, and that town is in really bad shape. I'm assuming even worse than it was when they shot the movie, probably the early 2010s, because there's no way things are better in Detroit. They've cloistered everything into one area. I guess the downtown core is probably fine, but that's going to be wealthy people, and everybody else, well, fuck them. They don't count anymore. They didn't before, and they sure as hell don't now.
Oh, yeah. I don't know if you can really credit Michael Moore with this, but there has been, in the last few decades, a real raised public consciousness about the perils of globalization, about the gap between the rich and the poor. Michael Moore, along with other smart artists, have realized that satire has proven to be a much more effective tool than anger. And that's certainly true when you watch shows like The Daily Show or The Colbert Report, John Oliver, Samantha Bee. These people have more of an influence on politics than the news does.
And the humor that all these people, including Moore, use is probably the reason why it works so well and why it's so popular.
Makes it incredibly accessible, and like everyone says, it speaks truth to power. It punches up. That's why the appeal lasts. And I think it'll last, too, because Michael Moore, whether you like him or not, you have to agree. And he always says this himself. He loves his country. And his heart is absolutely in the right place.
I agree with that for sure. I like him. I'm not trying to say
like him, too. And I understand he's probably an incredibly frustrating figure. But you cannot deny that this man has great intentions.
I'm not denying it.
I know you're not.
Okay.
Gosh.
So there's nothing in the awards section. We said no Oscars, no AFI lists. It was put in the National Film Registry in 2013, the same year as Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Pulp Fiction. So a very interesting trio of films, and obviously there's another 20 or so, but those are the three that stood out to me. Well, this is probably the most political podcast we've ever had, so let's wrap it up with our parting thoughts. This one's not been as much fun because it's been blood boiling.
I had fun!
But anyway, go ahead.
I feel like a real supporter.
So should I vote for you in the pageant? Oh, Miss America. Yeah, that's right. She goes on to win as well.
She goes on to win, and just a note for people who are really hardcore Stephen Colbert fans, you may recognize her in the public access show Only in Monroe. Stephen Colbert guest hosted with her once between the Colbert Report and the Late Show.
Oh, yeah. So she's still doing stuff.
Yeah.
Incidentally, the Sight and Sound list, when they did the 2012 grouping, they did one for documentaries. This was not in there. Forget what number one was. I've seen about half the documentaries in that list, I believe. Thin Blue Line, I think, was one of them. But we thought we'd cover one that we liked an awful lot. We'll maybe cover one of those ones later on, just like we should cover other Sight and Sound movies in the years to come of the podcast. We don't really have room this year necessarily to do some of those because they're, as I like to say way back when, hard vegetable soup. Like, what was it called? Tokyo Story, was it? The one that finished first on one of the lists?
Yes.
I don't know if I love the idea of watching, reviewing that one. Just like doing documentaries that are on the list of the top 10.
Yeah,
but this
films,
is a good choice because of the things that we've talked about, the politics of it and the fun of it and other movies like it.
Some films do just feel like homework.
Yes, and some of those definitely would. All right, so damn good movie. And one more plug for Hot Docs. If you're a fan of documentary films, you can go and just see one or two. You don't have to get a pass like we did. I forget how much it costs. It's a little more than a regular movie, I think, isn't it? But it can very much be worth it.
It used to be cheaper than a regular movie, and I think now their price is roughly about a regular movie. But yep. All the fun of a festival experience where you usually have a great crowd and Q&As to follow. Maybe you're going to see a film that you wouldn't otherwise get a chance to see.
I don't like standing in line, but I did not mind standing in line for those films. Although we did have passes that we won't have this year. We'll have to stand in line with their people where you're hoping to get a ticket, period.
The plebes.
No, I meant that we were guaranteed tickets. We were going to get in.
Yeah.
It was just a matter of having to wait to actually get a seat. All right, so that's the end of Roger and Me. In a week on the next 100 Project, we'll have something a lot different. Just a few days before May the 4th, we'll continue our tradition of covering a Star Wars movie on or around that date, because it'll be May the 2nd. This time, it's The Empire Strikes Back. The coming attractions trivia for The Empire Strikes Back. Of the 7 Star Wars movies, only one didn't finish first at the U.S. box office in the year it came out. Which one was it?
All right, so for the answer to that, please tune into next week's podcast. In the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and while you're there, please rate us, review us. It helps people find us. And you can also check out one of our, how many? 161?
Something like that. Around 160 total podcasts.
All the films that we've covered. It includes all 123 films that were ever listed on the AFI's Top 100 list of Best American Films ever made. You can follow us on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at Movie Fiend 51. Or perhaps you would prefer to message us privately. We really love to hear from you guys. Our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And before we go, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, sparkplugcoffee.com.
Pets or meat? I'll take the meat. I don't really like rabbits that much.
And cut.